The History of Literature podcast is a member of the Podglomerate Network and LitHub Radio.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hello, it was a golden age of war reporting and fiction. That period from, let's say, the 1920s to the 1980s, before the end of the Cold War and the rise of the internet took away some of its power and glamour. These were days when newspapers sent correspondents into battlefields for periodic updates on what was happening, and the correspondents, after trying to capture reality in the form of journalism, turned to fiction to attempt to capture some larger truths. Ernest Hemingway might stand as the ultimate example, and Frederick Forsyth and Graham Greene right behind him. James McManus stands firmly in this tradition. We talked to him about his days reporting on the war in Rhodesia in the 1970s as foreign correspondent for The Guardian, and his new novel, Love in a Lost Land, today on the History of Literature. Hello, 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 everyone. I'm Jack Wilson, the host of the podcast. Welcome to all of you. Thank you for stopping by. This is a day full of nostalgia. Nostalgia for those bygone days of journalistic courage, typewriters and newspapers, the world in which I grew up. A lot of us did. And as we were growing up, we looked to reporters like James McManus to tell us what was happening in the world. And then these guys so often turn to literature. We'll ask James why he did that. He now works for the Times Literary Supplement as its managing director. So he's very well positioned to talk about this move from journalism to fiction and literature. And then we'll close things out with my last book. Why don't we check in with our friend Peter K. Anderson, who wrote the biography of the real-life fool who lived with kings. Peter will tell us his choice for the last book he will ever read. But first, James McManus. Okay, joining me now is James McManus, the director of the Times Literary Supplement. He's also the author of several books, including Ocean Devil, The Life and Legend of George Hogg, On the Broken Shore, and Midnight in Berlin. He's here today to discuss his eighth book, Love in a Lost Land. James McManus, welcome to the History of Literature.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on your podcast.
So, Love in a Lost Land is inspired by the time you spent reporting on the war in Rhodesia in the 1970s as foreign correspondent for The Guardian in the UK. But I'd like to back up a little bit and ask how your career began. When did you start in the newspaper business, and what were you first working on?
I was at St Andrews University in Scotland studying history, and there I edited the university, or the student newspaper, I should say, and that just hooked me completely. I knew then what I wanted to do in my life. So when I left the university, I got a job on the Daily Express in Manchester, which was then, the paper was then a very big-selling newspaper. It was rather different from what it is today. And they didn't know what to do with me because I was a university graduate. I had a good sort of 2-1 in modern history. And so they made me the gossip columnist. And I had to go around the north of England talking to lots of lords and ladies.
Right. And then you became foreign correspondent. Had you reported on any wars before you went to Rhodesia?
Yes, I did. The Express sent me to Belfast in 1969-70. Mm-hmm. And at that time, it was a really terrible place. I mean, the sectarian warfare was killing completely innocent civilians. British troops were on the streets of Belfast, which was an absolute nonsense when you think about it. And my job, as I was the number three in the reporting team, was to go to explosions and shootings and acts of violence afterwards and talk to the survivors, which I did, which was a sort of a fairly kind of gruesome task. And the one thing that struck me about that and taught me a lot about dealing with people who had been in such situations was the sheer shock that these people were in. They could hardly talk, hardly sort of make sense of their feelings. And that, I think, influenced me greatly. It was a fairly terrible thing to witness.
even though you had the advantage of language and sort of probably some understanding of the culture, you weren't able to get them to open up because of what they had gone through.
Well, I don't want to exaggerate this. Of course, some people were, they all talked, but I mean, what they were saying was almost sort of stream of consciousness deriving from their shock. I mean, it wasn't sort of, a lot of it wasn't really kind of comprehensible.
Right, right. Okay, so then Rhodesia arises. What was happening in Rhodesia and how was it perceived by the outside world when you left?
I got to Rhodesia, and this time I was working for the Guardian newspaper in end of 1973-74. Rhodesia then was, in common parlance, a rebel racist regime, in which a small white minority of 250,000 odd were in charge, basically, and running the lives of 6 million Africans.
Mm.
And that was the sort of view from abroad. Mm-hmm. It wasn't quite like that when I got there.
Yeah. What was your assignment or what was your entry point? Were you just, I'm not sure how it works for foreign correspondents covering war.
I'll tell you exactly what happened. I was the Paris correspondent of The Guardian. I had a lovely time. I had a favorite restaurant. I had a beautiful French girlfriend and a white sports car. And in April 1974, the Portuguese coup happened in Lisbon. And the African colonies of Portugal, that's Angola, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau, became independent. And the Guardian said to me, go to Africa. So I did, and I never saw the white sports car or the girlfriend again.
Yeah, right. And they just basically, they leave it up to you. What do you do? Who you talk to? What you try to cover? And are you phoning back to an editor who gives you some instructions? Or how does that work?
Well, it's a very good question, actually, because it differs from paper to paper. The Guardian gave me a very free hand to work in what was then Rhodesia. The paper was a left wing. It was highly critical of the regime. And my job was to try and stay in there and report. In other words, not to take viewpoint stances and not to get into sort of condemnation of the regime from a moral point of view. Expressing moral viewpoints isn't really part of what a foreign correspondent should do.
Mm. Do you go in there with a feeling that you're going to be facing a lot of personal danger, or do you set that aside? What's your state of mind when you go?
Well, yes, it's another good question. I arrived there and I was a complete newcomer. I had never been to Africa before, let alone to this rebel regime, where the beginnings of the guerrilla war were beginning to make themselves felt on the white population. My sort of guiding kind of rule in all the journalism I've practiced is to talk to the little people, talk to the man behind the bar, talk to the man who is driving a taxi, talk to the women who are in the shops and try and get their viewpoint.
Mm.
Because if you're covering a war, obviously you've got to try and talk to those who are fighting it and those who are suffering from it. But equally, those who are suffering from it are normally the forgotten because they're the little people in the townships or out more often than not in Rhodesia, out in the bush. And it was those people I tried to talk to. Obviously, you listen to what the government says and you listen to what the spokespeople for the Nationalist Cause says. Of course you do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think by doing that, I sort of won a certain amount of respect from the regime who allowed me to stay there because as I said, I was trying to be even-handed.
Right. So the regime, for example, they're reading what you're writing as well. They're getting all the newspapers.
Absolutely. They see it on the way. And in those days, we had telex machines. That's the way we communicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny to think of that now.
Yeah.
they saw everything. But when I say I talk to the little people, I also talk to the white farmers and their families who are out way off in the bush and who were at risk. And they live behind, as it is, this is all in my book, actually, live behind barbed wire. And they had anti-grenade screens over the windows and so on and so forth. And I talked to them and tried to get their viewpoint as to why this war was going on, because it was quite clear to me very early on that this was a sort of a suicide mission, this white regime declaring illegal independence, facing sanctions, and then facing a guerrilla war. I mean, it was crazy.
Mm. And you say early in the book, the remembrance of those days still makes me shiver and reach for a glass of whiskey. What was it that was making the experience stand out like that?
Well, the 5 years I spent in that country covering that conflict and covering the outcome of it, finally the independence, getting to know people like Robert Mugabe quite well, the nationalist leader, were very, very memorable. They were very exciting for me. They taught me a huge amount, not just about what was going on there, but about myself. And that is why, looking back, I just feel not a sort of nostalgia, but I just feel that slight shiver of, did I do it right? Could I have done it better? And this is where the book has come from. I do draw very deeply on my experiences in that country at that time.
Why are you better positioned now to tell the story than you would have been at the time? Or what makes you think you can kind of second guess yourself in that way? Is it the passage of time, or have you learned something since then?
Well, first of all, this book is a novel, of course, although it's very historical, if you like. Looking back at what I did then, and yes, there are lots of things I would have changed. I would have, for instance, to take one example, I saw quite a lot of Robert Mugabe in exile after he fled the country in 1975, and I slightly fell for his sort of charm, if you like. He didn't tell me very much. I never got through to the inner man. He never revealed very much of himself. When one tried to talk about his family or his upbringing, you know, I learned a little bit about how the missionaries taught him English and how he studied English and how he liked the poetry of T.S. Eliot, which he later denied. But that was all. And I regret the fact that I didn't dig deeper.
Mm, right. Okay. So you also say that you found some romance in the war, and you define that carefully as romance in the old sense, the romance of men and women fighting against logic and history for a doomed cause. I mean, what was kind of motivating the people, and what was your view of them? Did it, you mentioned a little bit that it felt like it was a suicide mission, but it just, wonder if you could talk about the different players and kind of who the figures were and what they, how you viewed them at the time.
Well, what struck me most forcibly when I got there and I began to talk to the white community, be they in the towns or out on the farms, is that utter conviction that they had right on their side, that they were the best, this minority was the best answer for all the country. And I couldn't understand it, because they knew, and they admitted to me, that this was going to start a war. In fact, it had started a war, and a war they could not win. Mm-hmm. And I said to them, you're like the sort of the Jews at the Masada fortress when the Romans attacked. And, you know, we all know that story. They all committed suicide at the end, because they knew they were going to lose. And I said to these people, this is what's going to happen to you. You're not going to win this war. Why don't you settle now and strike the best possible deal you can? And they explained to me that I didn't understand the deep roots they had in the country, how they built it up. The initial pioneers came there in the 1890s, and the country developed in the 20s and 30s. But the interesting thing is that the country developed in a partnership between the white minority and the black majority, who provided the labor to build the roads, the dams, and the airfields, and so on and so forth. And that partnership was never recognized by the white minority. Had they somehow in the 30s understood that, there would have been a very different outcome in Rhodesia, I think.
Right. Okay, let's take a quick break and then come back with more from James McManus. Hello, everyone. This is Jack, here to tell you about a way to eat better and easier. That's right, Factor, and their delicious, ready-to-eat meals. These things are amazing, chef-crafted, always fresh, never frozen. All you do is heat them up and you're ready to go. No prepping, cooking, or cleanup, and you get something healthy, nutritious, and tasty. I love Factor meals, especially on those days when I'm in the office. They're better for me than snacks or junk food, and much cheaper and faster than buying my lunch at a restaurant. You can choose options like Calorie Smart, Protein Plus, Keto, and you can change your schedule to get as much or as little as you need every week, whatever suits you and your family best. Head to factormeals.com/literature50 and use code literature50 to get 50% off. That's code literature50 at factormeals.com/literature50 to get 50% off. Hey, grown-ups, the Cat in the Hat cast is a new podcast from Wondery, perfect for the whole family. Join the Cat in the Hat and your favorite Dr. Seuss characters as they get whisked away on a new adventure every week. Fish dreams of creating his very own polite and quiet podcast. That is, until he gets a surprise visit to his Fishbowl podcast studio from the Cat in the Hat himself. And it becomes very clear that the cat has other plans for the podcast, and those plans are the opposite of quiet. The cat may be disruptive, but it turns out he's also a great help to get Fish out of all kinds of predicaments. Bursting with music, silliness, and rhymes, the Cat in the Hat cast encourages us all to find fun that is funny in every episode. Sing along to new favorite songs, try your luck at Titanic tongue twisters, have some fun with wondrous wordplay, and most importantly, bring your family along for all of the adventures in the Cat in the Hat cast. Follow the Cat in the Hat cast on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to the Cat in the Hat cast ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Okay, we're back. So let's talk a little bit about what it's like to write a book like this and just maybe a little bit about being a war reporter in general. So you wrote this as a novel. What can you do with a novel that you couldn't do if you had tried to retrace these steps in nonfiction?
That's a very good question. Well, obviously, there are romantic affairs in this book. Mm-hmm. And my lead male character, Richard Brady, does work for a New York magazine, very like The New Yorker, in fact, although I didn't name it as such. And he does have an affair and fall in love with an African teacher, Patience, who works in the townships and who has a passion for teaching her students Shakespeare. Now, did that happen to me, my friends and other people, readers, ask? And the answer is, always in these sorts of stories, there's a sort of a composite element of the people you're putting together.
Right.
In this case, obviously, I was in the frame, so to speak, and Richard Brady does, without any question, draw heavily on the sort of person I was and what I was thinking at the time. I'm not sure I'm really answering your question, but I'm doing my best.
Yeah.
So the answer is, this is a work of imagination very much based on what happened. And the dividing line between what is imagination and what is fact is a very difficult one, and I'm not even sure that I can tell where that line is drawn.
Do you think you had in mind the reader and this is the effect I can produce in the reader? Or do you think you had in mind yourself and thinking, well, I'll be freer to write what I really want to write if I don't have to stick too closely to the truth and I have room for my imagination to do some work here?
Again, a good question. I always think of the reader. And one of the things that in all my novels, I have sort of made sure that I have a fairly fast moving narrative. I believe in getting the reader to turn the pages and wanting to know what happens next.
Yeah.
I don't do that to the point where I sort of overlook or ignore the side stories and the characters, because characterization is obviously vital. If readers don't buy into a character, they're not going to follow the story through. I'm not sure if that answers the question.
No,
Yeah,
I think so. Do you feel like, I mean, often people will say, well, in some ways, fiction can get at a greater truth than nonfiction. There's, because of the power of fiction and the power of storytelling and the way fiction can kind of balance different outcomes or different, can keep contradictory things both afloat at the same time, which is actually maybe closer to the truth.
I absolutely 100% agree with that. Mm. And that's why I write fiction. Mm-hmm. It does get to areas that, quite frankly, nonfiction can't get to. There's been no proper history written of the Rhodesian conflict, what began it, and what it led to. There's been an awful lot of reporting about that, and there have been some side stories, books, and so on and so forth. And I do think, and I have been told this by Zimbabwean citizens living here who become my readers in England, that it does take them back to what their parents were going through in the 70s. And it's not just what the Africans were going through, although they paid a very big price out in the countryside for the war. It's what the young white people, boys and girls, young men and women, also felt. They were sort of born into that society and, if you like, trapped by it. They had no choice in where they were going to be born, did they? And when the call up came, the boys were given a gun and off they went into the bush. So I can describe those things much more clearly and bring them to the attention of the reader in fiction than I could possibly have done in fact.
Right. Okay. Let's talk a little more broadly about war reporting in general. And how do you, I mean, we've talked about this a little bit, but how do you do it? I mean, what do you set yourself some guidelines or some rules? How do you make sure that you're being objective, or is objectivity even sort of the goal? Or how do you avoid taking sides? Or how do you present to your audience an accurate picture when there are, you know, your sympathies might be leaning in one direction or another, or you might feel like one side has a more just cause? Or how do you balance all of that?
Well, you do start in any conflict, because I also worked in the Middle East after my time in Africa, with the absolute sort of iron rule that you are going to be fair to all sides, you are going to be objective. It's almost impossible to do that, because when you talk to both sides in a conflict, you're not getting the truth. You're getting their version that they want you to report. And so you then have to make a judgment as to whether you repeat what is essentially a propagandist sort of account that they give you of what's going on, or try and make your own judgment. And of course, in making your own judgment, you are inevitably influenced by what you think and feel about the situation. And so it is extremely difficult. And I have utter admiration for the correspondents, British, American, French, whatever, who are in the Middle East right now, trying to deal with an extremely difficult, tragic situation in which truth is very hard to find.
Is the answer to try to be upfront about one's leanings and inclinations? But that's not always the kind of reporting that I read or value. It you know, not everything is a personal essay. There are facts that can be presented in a more of a straight news format. But is how do reporters try to manage their own potential for bias?
Yes. Again, a good question. It's very difficult to answer that, because in every single case, you know, it differs. Some reporters are just openly enamored with one side in a conflict and make that clear, and it is clear to the readers. But that completely destroys what they're trying to say, in my view, anyway. I think if the reader of a newspaper article understands that the reporter is doing his best to try and get to the actual sort of truth of the matter, and is not rushing to judgment, as we've seen with the bombing of the hospital in Gaza, of course, everybody, including the New York Times, rushed to one conclusion, which now turns out to be pretty certainly false. So it's not easy, as the answer, and you simply have to, at the end of the day, when you have a very large whiskey and try to forget some of the horrors you've seen, just sit down and say, did I get that right? And then you probably add stuff and add, you know, it's tough.
Do you feel like when you're in a country like that, you're aware of the other reporters and you're thinking, well, I know so-and-so is going to accept this version because they're more inclined to accept what one side says.
Sure.
And so you're all kind of, you're doing the same job, but you're aware that you're doing it in different ways.
Absolutely. I mean, in Rhodesia, what was then Salisbury, there was a club that journalists used to gather in called the Quill Club. In Lebanon, when I was there, there was a Commodore Hotel. In these places, journalists would always gather after their trips to work out in the field and discuss what they'd seen and what they'd written. And we sort of knew who was actually pretty much taking one side or not really giving the full truth. But you don't argue about it, because you just have your whiskey and get ready for the next day. It's essential that you keep, I mean, the camaraderie amongst journalists is very, very strong, because after all, they're taking big risks. And certainly in Lebanon, we were.
And there may be, I mean, I don't know if you're able to see it this way at the time, but it seems like, you know, just considering that scenario, there is some value in having these multifaceted, you know, having 10 reporters with slightly different motives would be better than having one, it seems like.
I think that's probably true. I don't think press, you know, newspapers and TV can really afford to have more than one or two maybe at the time. Of course, when the story gets back to the foreign desk and the editor, they then have to make another judgment.
right.
as to whether, in their view, the reporter is being fair and being objective and trying at least to get to the truth of the story. So there is a sort of second edit barrier, if you like, before the thing goes into print.
And what we always hear today is that the reporters don't write the headlines, and sometimes the headline is as important as the story itself in kind of
absolutely
giving an angle on something.
Absolutely. That is so right. That's so right. Yeah.
Okay. So you're there in the 1970s. Who were your models? Was there an earlier generation of war reporters that you were looking to as the examples to follow?
Absolutely. I was then, and I'm now, a passionate admirer of A.J. Liebling's reporting in the Second World War.
Yeah,
he was a New Yorker writer. He covered that conflict in North Africa, then in France after D-Day, all the way through to Berlin. He was a fabulous writer. Of course, he didn't just do that. He wrote the classic book on boxing, The Sweet Science. He wrote sort of about a dozen books. But to my mind, he was, with Ernie Pyle, who was a Scripps Howard reporter, the two greatest reporters of the Second World War. And I've got a copy of his war reports here, which the Nebraska University Press produced some years ago. And I read it at night sometimes just to admire the very calm way. He didn't, and this is classic, he talked to the soldiers. He interviewed prisoners when he could. He tried to get both those very opposite sides to tell him what they'd been through. And it was always the ordinary GI that he got his information from. I mean, I would recommend to anybody listening to your program to take a look at his writing.
Yeah. Were there models that you viewed as negative examples? Was there a school or a type of reporting that you were trying to avoid doing?
I don't think so, no. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can go back to Hemingway, of course, who was involved as a war reporter, not for very long, but of course, and then who got a great book out of it. And he changed the style with which writers delivered their books, I think. He had a huge impact. And if I can just put a side thought in here, my passion as a young man was William Faulkner. I read all his books. Now I can't read him. The sentences go on forever and ever. Yet you go back to Hemingway, and he writes in beautiful, crisp, short prose that is so easy to read.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's just a side issue.
Right. Well, what appealed to you about Faulkner when you did like Faulkner?
Oh, it was, I can't pronounce the country.
The Yaknapatapa County.
Exactly. Yeah. I've never been able to pronounce that. Oh, it was the country, the mood, the people. He just conjured up a world, which
right.
for somebody in England age 16 was extraordinary. And you got into it. And at that age, 16, 17, one had the patience, surprisingly enough for a young man, to actually read all this and to get into it. As I Lay Dying is a great book. Light in August is a great book. But the style really, I think, inhibits a modern day audience from getting into it.
Right. Well, that's interesting because there is a famous example here in the States of the writer John Gardner, who happened to be Raymond Carver's teacher. And one of pieces of advice that he gave him was, read all the Faulkner that you can, and then read all the Hemingway you can to get Faulkner out of your system.
I didn't know that, but that's good advice.
Sounds like something similar to what you've done in your life.
Yes.
So what was it like? I mean, you were in Paris and Hemingway had been in Paris. Did he have a kind of looming presence for you as a correspondent or as someone who was interested in literature?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Hemingway was in Paris in the 20s, and he was so lucky because he was there with literary greats, Gertrude Stein, James Joyce, Scott Fitzgerald, Ezra Pound. And there's a lovely story about Hemingway when he sent his first collection of short stories to, he was completely unknown, to Gertrude Stein. And she sent them back with a crisp note saying, "Start over and concentrate." And Hemingway, this all comes out in Hemingway's book, A Movable Feast.
Yes.
And I cannot recommend that strongly enough to your listeners. It's got it all in there, all of the great people, James, the mad Scott Fitzgerald, and all the rest of it. It's a brilliant book.
Mm-hmm. It really is. I mean, my wife has not a whole lot of time for Hemingway and a lot of the you know, bullfighting and boxing and so on. But she loves A Movable Feast. It is,
it's a brilliant book.
Yeah, it really is wonderful. So you mentioned that Hemingway sort of changed everything for correspondents and writers who were, I guess, traveling abroad or who were in a war zone, or I'm not sure exactly what you meant, but what did you mean by that?
Well, he was in France, wasn't he? He was up on the Italian border when he got injured in the First World War, of course. And I think he was driving ambulances at the time, if I can go back. Yes, he was. And then he got injured. And all that comes out in, now, hang on, which one is it?
A Farewell to Arms.
A Farewell to Arms, exactly. Sorry. So that's what he was doing. I mean, he didn't have a great war, if you like. He didn't go through it all as, say, A.J. Liebling did in terms of actually witnessing combat. But it was enough to enable him to write a great book.
Mm-hmm. Did you have him in mind as someone who could experience the war as a newspaper correspondent as he was and sort of earn your living that way, but then someday have the material to write novels?
I certainly didn't model myself on him. I think that would have been a mistake. He's a great example for any young writer, any old writer for that matter, because he did turn his journalism into very good books, certainly the first one.
Yeah.
But my models, the people who influenced my writing most of all, probably are, Hemingway certainly was one, but I liked, hang on, who wrote The Long Goodbye? Who was that? I don't know why that name's gone out of my head, because he's a favorite of mine. But just to mention, the other writer that really has influenced me a lot is P.G. Wodehouse. And he's often dismissed as just a light comedy writer, but actually his prose style is extraordinary and beautifully written, beautifully balanced sentences, amazing sort of grasp of the English language, and beautiful choice of words. And a very light writer. Again, if you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and want to get back to sleep, he's not a bad one.
And The Long Goodbye, were you talking about Raymond Chandler?
Of course I was. I'm sorry. I had an absolute brain fade there.
Yeah. So another very readable writer. Yeah.
That is the duty, surely, of a writer, is to be readable, to connect with the readership and as wide a readership as possible.
Right.
And I sometimes think modern fiction has lost that sort of lesson.
They may be reading Faulkner without the corrective.
Yes, exactly.
Since we're sort of pivoting to that, you're given your current role and the work you've done working for the Times Literary Supplement, you seem especially well positioned to comment on trends in literary fiction. And I was wondering if you've seen any developments in the past few years or decades that have struck you.
Yes, there have been lots, haven't there? I mean, I think a lot of young writers write through the prism of current political trends, the Me Too movement, cultural trends, I should say, the Me Too movement, the whole gender issue, diversity issues. I think that's a mistake. Not because these are political decisions, because, of course, great writers have always been political. Dickens and Tolstoy and Victor Hugo and Stendhal. You know, politics is essential almost in any great novel, even if you look at them. But I think they get into single issues that I think they've forgotten. There's too much banging of the drum. I think that's what goes on in what a lot of young novelists are doing these days. Mm-hmm. Too much projecting a certain viewpoint and doing so without any sort of balance at all. The other thing that's really happened, which is a good thing, is that women writers have really come to the fore in the last 10, 15, maybe 20 years. I mean, we've always had great women writers from the time of, well, like we can go back and name Jane Austen, if you like. And they've come up, you know, you've got young Zadie Smith here in England, who has done a lot of work in America, of course, and those sorts of writers. I think we've lost touch with the need for a writer, A, to appeal to a readership, and B, to obviously sell books. And if you look at Ian McEwan. Now, Ian McEwan deals with big issues, but he does so in a way that actually takes the reader from page to page. He has a very strong sense of narrative. And that, I think, is lost on a lot of young, kind of new to the market writers. They seem to be in love with their own viewpoints and less concerned with character and less concerned with narrative. So I can't tell you that I really admire any single modern young writer. I can't.
Well, I wonder if this is just to sort of circle back to what we talked about at the beginning, when we talked about fiction being able to get at truth in a way that nonfiction is kind of superior to nonfiction, in that it can ask you to hold contradictory ideas in balance with one another and see the truth in kind of the difficult questions rather than the easy and obvious ones. And I wonder if People have sort of stopped trusting fiction to do that and instead feel like, well, if I give the opposing point of view and kind of show that, you know, that a person is wrestling with something that is a very difficult problem, instead I'll try to solve the problem and I'll put that in here and then everyone will pat me on the back for being on the right side or, you know, for having come up with some answers or something. And instead they're missing out that a lot of it is letting the reader kind of see the tension and sort that out for themselves.
I quite agree with that. I mean, I absolutely do agree with that. And I'm trying to think of the last great sort of big novel that did that. And I'm not going to go back to Dickens' Great Expectations, but I mean, I do think we are missing in the current literary world big figures who can actually really embrace the reader and deliver big thoughts, judgments, or just huge opportunities for the reader to open a door into a different world. Mm. And I can't think of a writer who does that at the moment.
Mm. Wow. Okay. So any sense that fiction, where it's likely to head next, it sounds like if we don't have any practitioners who are even taking that on, maybe we're just going to have a diminished kind of fiction, genre fiction, or more entertainment-based fiction, but not the kind of literary fiction that we were maybe used to when we were growing up.
Well, let me add a corrective to what I've just said, because
okay,
books are still selling.
Mm-hmm.
And here in England, September, October is the big book season when publishers get the books out for Christmas. And there are literally, scores or maybe hundreds of new novels out there. You go into bookshops and they have absolutely tables full of these things. And publishers do this because they do make money out of them. I mean, those books sell. Of course, what they actually do is throw out, say, 10 novels, and if one sells, then they make the money back.
Mm.
Sorry to be commercial, but it is a commercial business at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So it's not that people aren't reading books, but I hear over and over again this sort of mantra that if I don't get beyond page 20 or 30, I don't follow through. I'm not sure that people are really reading books to the end anymore. I mean, the paperback cost here 12, 14, 15 pounds. That's quite a lot of money to spend on a book you're not going to read through.
Mm. Right. Okay. Well, I hate to leave things on kind of a pessimistic note, but maybe I could say we do have a good example of a book where people might enjoy reading it in the old sense of learning a lot from fiction, but also not being hit over the head with the answers, and that is Love in a Lost Land. So James McManus, thank you for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you very much indeed. That was a real pleasure talking to you.
Good stuff. And finally today, we check in with Peter K. Anderson. After we talked about the history of fools, who they were, and how they came to serve various kings and queens, I asked him this special question. Okay, I'm here with Peter Anderson, author of the book Fool, In Search of Henry VIII's Closest Man. Peter, this question comes from a listener who asks, what do you want your last book to be? This will be the last book you will ever read. You can either choose one that exists or describe one that has not yet been written.
Well, that's a very difficult question. But I think when I try to put myself into that position, I think that I would sort of like to go back to the ultimate symbols of safety and comfort,
mm,
and then go back to the books that I loved as a child.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And things that I've gone back to throughout my life, and I've been thinking about that because there's quite a lot of, obviously, but if I'm going to choose one thing, I think it would be one of the Tintin books.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
And so that was, how old were you when you were reading those?
Oh, I don't know. Probably around 10 begins in that age. That's when you try to start to sort of appreciate Tintin, and then you can read it all, you know, through your teens, and even as an adult you can, mm-hmm, you can find other aspects of it, the humor and the adventure, but especially the sort of dramaturgy and the structure of these books is very very sophisticated. And even there's even a small dash of postmodernism in the last ones that Hergé drew. And I'm thinking about which one, because it can't be all of them, obviously. And I have a few favorites, but I think the one that I keep coming back to is Tintin in Tibet, which is the most poetic one, which it has such beautiful images, and at the same time it has this sort of dreamlike quality. There's something very, very profound in that one, which you can cherish both as an adult, but which is also very appealing to a child, because it's a very exciting adventure story, of course.
Yeah, it is such an all-immersive world to read Tintin. You just fall right into those illustrations, and it almost feels like, it feels as real as reality.
Exactly. Only I wish that reality looked like that.
Yeah,
I wish that buildings and streets and cars looked like that. There is a dose of nostalgia in reading Tintin, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't have nostalgia for it. It wasn't something I was reading a lot when I was a kid. I had seen them, but I didn't own any or anything. But I do have nostalgia for a trip I took to Tibet, which is a really important place to me. So maybe I need to consider Tintin in Tibet. Maybe I need to put that on my short list for my final book as well.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a bit about final things.
Right. Okay. Well, Peter Anderson, thank you so much for joining me on the History of Literature.
Thank you.
So there you have it, Tintin in Tibet and Rhodesia in the 1970s. We are traveling around this January. Well, this is the time to dream of travels. I hope you have some good journeys in store for you this year. My thanks to James McManus and to Peter K. Anderson for joining me on this other journey I'm taking, this journey through literature. I'm Jack Wilson. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.